And it is my huge pleasure today to welcome back a former Prime Media colleague who has written a very difficult but really important book that delves very deep into issues of toxic masculinity, into sexual assault at schools, grooming of victims, and talking about the repetitive cycle of abuse as well. The book is called Brutal School Ties, and it probes the background to a series of incidents which have rocked the very well-known, once very highly regarded Gauteng school, Parktown Boys High School. Those included an initiation abuse scandal many years ago, the more recent case of the sports coach Colin Rex being convicted on multiple counts of sexual assault of boys in his care, and then, of course, more recently, the tragic drowning of people Enoch Mpianzi during the school's grade 8 camp just a couple of months ago. And in unraveling the personal stories behind these incidents, Sam really forces the reader to question, what are we teaching our boys? What are we telling our boys about what it means to be a man? And she finds that sometimes the monsters we like to blame for this kind of thing are themselves, to some degree, victims of a system gone wrong. Sam Cowan, as many of you will know, is a former radio presenter. She's a motivational speaker and professional consciousness coach. She's worked in media for well over two decades. She's previously written four books, including her wonderful best-selling memoir, From Whiskey to Water. And Sam, it's welcome back to Prime Media and to Cape Talk. So great to have you with us today.
Oh, it's lovely to be here. Thanks, Pippa.
Just want to say we are live streaming the interview on Facebook if you'd like to watch as well as listen. But otherwise, communicate in the usual ways. Ask a question, share a comment, send us an SMS to 31567, tweet us at Cape Talk, or you're welcome to call in on 021-446-0567 or drop a voice note to 072-567-1567. Would love to hear from anybody else who's already read the book or who has perhaps personal experience with the issues we're talking about that you'd like to reflect on. Sam, I mean, this was a headline-grabbing story. Firstly, the sexual assault scandal a couple of years ago, then, of course, the terrible tragedy of the loss of Enoch Mpianzi earlier this year. But what was it that piqued your interest to the point that you thought, this is a book I want to write and a story I want to tell?
Well, the thing is, I like telling stories. I like narrative. And I interviewed a series of women for a podcast series I did last year on women who've overcome insurmountable problems or seem to be insurmountable. And one of the ladies was Olivia Jezreel, who I'm sure you know is one of Bob Hewitt's rape victims. Mm. And she said to me, the reason I interviewed her is because what I find with sexual abuse, GBV, all of the statistics that we sit with, it's just statistics, it's numbers. But when you hear from a 50-year-old woman who was raped at the age of 12 that she still baths in bleach, that's when you sit back and you go, wow, that's the impact. If I tell you 1,000 women get raped every day, you'll be, oh, that's awful. But when I tell you about that, and she said to me, you need to do this for the Parktown boys. So I said, well, I wouldn't even know where to start with boys, number one. And number two, it was years ago. And she said, it's not years ago. And she said, the boys are still being bullied and brutalized and at school. And she said that they battle to make peace. Their parents are still in a state. And I was shocked because I would have thought boys who came forward would have been heroes, would have been fated as heroes. It's not easy to come forward, especially when you're young, especially when the person who has assaulted you, you saw as your friend. But that was exactly what did happen. It got shoved under the rug. And so I decided that I would like to talk to the people who were there. And from there grew the idea of making it a narrative. So I wrote the book in the words of the boys. It's interviews with them. It's their very own words. It's the words of the teachers. It's the word of Colin Rex himself, his mum, his girlfriend. Anyone who would talk to me, the matron, everybody who was there who wanted to talk to me is in the book telling the story as they remember it. And I think that's the power of it, is in their words. Mm. I just wrote it down.
There are words that shock, that make you cry, that made me want to vomit in some cases, Sam. I'm the mother of a 13-year-old boy. I know you've got a teenager as well. It's to read what happened to these boys and the impact it had, and to read the number of adults who should have stepped in to intervene but didn't, is sickening. Getting access, though, to those boys must have been a huge challenge and something that had to be trod very delicately, because I'm very aware reading this how careful you were not to become part of the chain of secondary victimization. You were very careful about wanting these boys to be able to share their stories but not making it worse for them in the process. Talk to us a little bit about how you approached that.
So what I did was I said to all of the – first of all, I did never approach any of the boys on their own. I approached their parents. And I said to them – what I was doing and how I was doing it. And I said, it'll only be your words. I won't twist them. And I also promised them I would not approach their sons on their own. I asked them if they would, but if they weren't comfortable, I wouldn't push it. And quite a few mums came back and said, look, rather not. And I said, fine, and I left that. And then one by one, as the boys started talking to me, and I was also talking to the matron, Mariolette, at the time, who's just the hero of the piece, actually. And she was saying to me, possibly this boy will talk to you. Possibly this boy will talk to you, because she trusted me. And I said to them, and I won't, and the other thing I said to them is, I said, I don't expect you to be okay with this. Any detail that you are comfortable to give me, I will take. But if I ask a question that's going too far in any direction, you say to me, Sam, I'm not comfortable with that, and I'll stop. So one of the criticisms that I got from, funnily enough, one or two of the parents said that there wasn't enough brutality in the book. And I said, I think that's because you've lived with it for so long that it doesn't seem as awful. I said, I assure you there's enough brutality in the book. But that was how I did it.
I mean, you've just nailed there one of the most crucial issues of this whole piece. It's recognizing that normalizing abhorrent behavior makes it so much harder to report and to recognize as being abhorrent. And that is something that almost every one of the boys you spoke to has grappled with, that the kinds of forms of abuse, of physical abuse, of verbal abuse, of sexual abuse that were going on around them were happening so blatantly and so often, and with so many people looking on in some cases and saying nothing, that they question themselves. They're going, well, maybe I'm the only one who thinks this is wrong, because clearly nobody else in this room does.
Well, what I think got to me so much with some of the boys that I interviewed was how they said this was just another hardship. Mm-hmm. And two or three of the boys actually said, I just thought this was what school was like. Oh. I thought this was just school.
Sam, maybe we need to pause and take a moment to recap a couple of the bare bones details for the sake of those listeners who don't recall the specific information we're talking about. We're talking here about Parktown Boys High School in Johannesburg. It's one of the, and has for a long time been, one of the leading all-boys schools in the city, a stellar reputation for over 100 years. And first inklings came back in, I think, 2009 with a carte blanche expose that some listeners might remember of, shall we call them, initiation practices and physical abuse, particularly in the school hostel. But it was in 2016 that the water polo coach and hostel master, Colin Rex, was arrested towards the end of 2016. And Sam, just talk us through briefly what happened next.
So what happened was, he was arrested because he was caught on CCTV footage fondling boys, and not just one or two. There were a lot in the room at the time. And he was arrested that night because what had happened was, one of the boys, in the book he has been, had brought it to the attention of the head of the hostel, Chris Bossett, and his wife, Mariolette, who's sort of the unofficial and now official matron, and went in and said, a bag of water polo caps have gone missing, and I think they were in the common area on this day. But he knew where they were, and they weren't in the common area. He said he had reached a point where it had to stop. And I think it's a really important qualification to make, is that he wanted it to stop. At that stage, they weren't thinking of him being arrested or going to prison or anything like that. So once Chris and Mariolette saw it, they were utterly shocked. And they said to him, you need to go back to the hostel. Don't say anything to anyone. We are going to deal with this. And he said, this is nothing. It happens to all of us all the time, and sometimes worse. And they were absolutely blown away. And the other thing is that when things are happening in the hostel, it's a very insular place. It's very small. And everyone is in everyone's bedroom. Everyone is in everyone's shower. I mean, it's a boys' school, you know. So from there, Colin Rex was arrested and taken to Hillbrow Police Station. But a case had to be built. And currently all they had were a couple of boys on tape who hadn't gone on record yet. Mm. I mean, the story of Jonah's mom, who drove all the way through to the school in the rain. I know where she lives, and I know how far away the school is. And it's a 45-minute journey at the best traffic times, and she made it in 22 minutes.
Sure.
So that 22 minutes, was, she said, was the worst of her life. Just trying to imagine what had happened to her boy when they phoned her and said, you need to come now. So after the arrest, Colin was charged with several charges. He wasn't allowed back into the school. And he said, when I spoke to him, he said the charges just kept getting more and more. He said at first it was 6, then it was 8, then it was 80, then it was 100, and eventually it was 327 charges. And when he went to prison, eventually, he had just turned 23, just. He went to prison for as long as he'd been alive. And he's there now.
And you interviewed him there now, and we'll talk about that in the second half hour. 327 charges by the time he got to court. He was ultimately convicted on 144 counts of sexual assault and 12 of common assault. He was described by the judge as a serial sexual offender and a sexual bully. They were the most charges I think any human being in the South African legal system's history had ever faced in one case. Is that correct?
I've been told that. Yes. Yeah. I've been told that as well. It is unbelievable. The enormity of the docket was just huge, huge. And it grew and grew and grew like a ward.
Now, the number of boys who had come forward was, I think, 23 by the time they finally got to court. But from what the matron, Maria, later said to you, that list is much longer. There are some boys who have chosen not to be part of the case and not to come forward. Why do you think that is, Sam?
So a couple of the boys were going to come forward, and then their parents suggested they didn't. And I can't obviously presume that. I didn't speak to those parents. They didn't want to talk to me. Yeah. But I can only assume that they saw so many boys have come forward. They didn't actually want their boys to go through what these ones were going to go through. That court process is brutal. It is brutal. It is absolutely terrible. And I understand the process of justice, et cetera, but when you read and you hear those boys' stories of how they knew he could see them, how when the light went on, you could see who was in the little room, you know, how the judge would ask them questions, how legal would trip them up. It is absolutely brutal what they went through. It really, really is.
Particularly so for the boy that you've called Ben. And you used fake names for every one of them and left it up to those boys to say, you're in the book. Yeah. If you at some point in the future choose to disclose to the people that you know and love that you are Ben, that's up to you, but I'm not going to be the person who does that, which I think is really, really important. Ben, who is the boy who was brave enough to make sure that this was exposed, was 18 by the time the trial started. That meant he had to face a full-on open court, unlike all the other boys who testified in private. Ben was there face-to-face with Colin Rex the whole time, wasn't he?
He was, and it was, I said to him, how was that? No, it was good. I just looked at him the whole time, but you know, having said that, he'd been in a psychiatric unit. He wrote his exams from a psychiatric hospital. He has the enormity of what had happened to him. I mean, of those 144 charges, sexual charges, to which he pleaded guilty, to which Colin pleaded guilty, Ben was 57 of them. And that's when his mum had a nervous breakdown, because they were reading the charges out in court over and over and over, and the name kept coming up over and over. And I said to his dad, I said, how many charges did you think? He said, look, we knew it was a lot. He said, we thought like maybe 20. But when it hit 30 and when it hit 40 and when it hit 50, I mean, imagine your child, you're sitting there thinking, this has got to end. This has got to end. So he had to testify as an adult. And he also, he tried, because it's very difficult for children to tell exactly when they've been assaulted, when it's been multiple assaults. The judge would say to him, well, on what day? How do you come up with this? Because he'd said there were about 20 times. The judge said, well, how did you come up with 20 times? And he said, well, I was averaging it out that it would happen this many times in a month. The judge said, no, and threw it all out. And so it was one charge per child, as opposed to all these other charges. Mm-hmm. And that was a hell of a slap back for these kids to say, I'm on antidepressants. I've been to hospital. I can barely see straight. I still have to write my exams. And the judge going, no, you can't remember the details. It's not happening. Mm-hmm. And who does, you know, on a serial abuse? Can you say, can anyone say, well, on the 4th of April at 11:14? It's impossible. It's an impossible system.
Mm-hmm. It is a system, though, and the system is crucial here, that it's very easy. And I think you say that maybe going into this story, you thought, Sam, that you were going to be telling the story of Colin Rex, the monster who abused the boys of Parktown Boys High. You found something very different. And after the news headlines, we'll talk a bit more about Colin's own story and about the school system. But just to recap briefly, I mentioned the Carte Blanche expose, which had happened in 2009. At the time that came out, and that was much more focused on physical abuse of the boys, beatings, you know, midnight rituals and the kind that was unfortunately not uncommon at one time in South Africa schooling history, but which was meant to have disappeared. Post 2009, there was a huge outcry after that expose about changing the school culture, changing this, doing away with initiation. The one former teacher who did speak to you was adamant that this did not go on in the school and it was not condoned by the school. He was blaming the school governing body parents for disrespecting teachers. Was it a case of an entire system and an entire school turning a blind eye and carrying on as normal? Or do you think there had been some genuine effort to change after that first expose?
I think there was such a shock because, as you say, it's 100 years of tradition. That school was known for being brave and strong and true. Some amazing people have come out of Parktown Boys and will continue to come out of Parktown Boys. What's wrong is that people, I feel, and I wrote this in the book, are too intent on trying to protect the reputation of the school and not enough on trying to fix the problem. So very briefly, because I'm also watching the time from being one of myself, very briefly, if I can liken it to a biscuit factory. If you've got a biscuit factory that makes the most amazing shortbread for years and years and years and years, you're known for your shortbread, but you never look after the machine. And when something goes wrong in the machine, you kind of patch it and hope it'll be okay. But the biscuits are coming out misshapen. People are complaining about the quality of them. Then if you had a biscuit factory, you'd shut that bit down. You'd repair the machinery. You'd run a new batch through for people to see. And then it would be fixed. But this is not what happened. What happened here is people said, are you complaining about the biscuits? You hate the biscuit factory. You don't want anyone to have biscuits. So if that's the case, no one's saying that. I don't want the school shut down. I've been accused of that. I don't want Parktown Boys to disappear. I've been accused of that. I want them to fix the system. I want them to fix the biscuit factory.
Because it's There's a biscuit factory, yeah, and it's a biscuit factory that I think is representative of biscuits, making all kinds of different biscuits all over the country. Yeah. I don't think this is anything that is singular to this particular school.
Play Cape Talk.
Join the conversation the smart way.
This is Cape Talk.
We are back in conversation with Sam Cowan, the author of the new book, Brutal School Ties, The Parktown Boys Tragedy. And it is published by Melinda Ferguson Books, available in stores now. It is a book that deals with the case of Colin Rex, who was a hostel master and water polo coach at the school, convicted on 144 counts of sexual assault of the boys under his care and sentenced to 23 years in jail. It also, though, delves into traditions at the school and a tradition of physical abuse, verbal abuse, etc., of the boys, particularly in their grade 8 year. And the grade 8 camp, Sam, comes up again and again with the level of extraordinary abuse that many of the boys over the years were subjected to. So much so that fast forward to 2020, when you have the tragedy of young Enoch Mpianzi not surviving the grade 8 camp, it actually brought a lot of boys forward to talk where who hadn't done so before, didn't it?
And I think, I mean, it was wonderful to be able to talk to them. Three who weren't so sure, I had spoken to their parents, came forward and said, we'd like to talk to you. And in fact, one boy said 2 days before deadline, I would like to talk to you. I nearly had a heart attack. I'm not going to lie. I was like, oh, are you sure? Because they blamed themselves. And this was the most traumatic thing. So the death of Enoch Mpianzi was gross negligence. It wasn't initiation. It wasn't a cruelty deliberately done. It was gross disgusting negligence. And there I am quite judgmental. Mm. But the boys on the camp, the matrix on that camp, they were there with the hashtag, it stops with me. And what they were doing on the camp, while all of that dreadfulness was going on, they were actually in a room working out what they were going to take that was good from their grade eight and bring it to this grade eight and discard what was bad.
Wow.
So there, it stops with me was going to be the beginning of a whole new era. And so the tragedy was that people did blame those matrix. Social media was all over the place saying, no, this was definitely initiation. These boys were off the charts. And so a few came to talk to me and say, we would like to talk to you now because we think that perhaps we should have spoken up earlier. And I hated that they felt that way.
Yeah.
One boy who's way out of the school, so he didn't know, he was utterly convinced that if he'd spoken up beforehand, Enoch would not have died. And I said to him, Enoch would still have died.
What a burden to carry, sure.
But and that's the thing. That's the thing with boys, because boys don't talk. They don't talk. And they're encouraged not to talk. We encourage them not to. Big boys don't cry. You cry, you die. Stitches get stitches. What goes on tour stays on tour. Mm-hmm. No one says that to girls. They don't. You know, and the other thing with the boys is that is the guilt comes from not fighting off the sexual advances. Because there's a generally accepted understanding that when a woman is raped, she asked for it. You know, that she deserved it because she was drinking or she was walking along in the dark or doing something equally appalling, dreadful,
like wearing
in and out.
Yeah.
There you go. But when a boy is, but when a woman gets it, it's generally understood that it is not good and she cannot fight it off. Generally speaking, women are weaker physically than men. But when we grow our boys up to be protectors and they cannot protect themselves, the level of guilt and shame is absolutely suffocating. Mm. Because what happened with a lot of these boys were people saying to them, yeah, you liked it. Why don't you say anything? You liked it. One boy was in a rugby game in the scrum, and one of the other teams said to him, yeah, we know you like jerking people off. And that was the end of the game. Yeah. You know, how do you do that? You go to a new school, you start a new life, you think you're safe, and it comes back to haunt you.
And even those who stayed, who were brave enough to come forward, the secondary victimization that happened within the school was, I mean, I just want to share a quote here from the hostel matron, Mariolette, who wrote, "In the meantime, the victim boys who had come forward were very scared, ashamed, and sad because by then everyone knew who they were. They were embarrassed to face the other boys or go to prep. They would sit and do their homework at my house and cried almost every night. They were teased beyond imagination, called gay and liars, not only by their mates and other students, but also by some of the teachers." And that terrible line, snitches get stitches. Sam, I saw it all over social media at the time of Enoch Mpianzi's death, and I didn't fully appreciate what it meant and how woven into the fabric of the school culture it was. But this code of silence of, as you said, what happens on camp stays on camp, what happens at school stays at school was something that was handed down generation after generation of boys at that school, wasn't it?
Mm. So this is the thing. So all those initiations got more and more vicious as the years went on. So what may have, and I say may have, I didn't go back. I took the coat hanger of the 2014-15 situation and I put that coat on. But what a lot of people told me going back is that the initiations were more, in inverted commas, fun, because I don't think ever having DP rubbed on your private parts can be fun. Mm. But it was done in a far more joshing manner, whereas it's become absolutely untenable. I mean, one of the boys, his initiation was so bad that he still has gravel in his knuckles to this day from knuckle push-ups. You know, that grade 8 camp. So the boys go on the grade 8 camp, and they, as soon as they get there, they were forced into PT, and it would be hours. They'd have to hold a plank position for 3 hours, and if somebody lost it, everyone had to do it again. One boy was bleeding so hard, his matric said to him, "You should be pleased to bleed for your brothers. This is what you need to do." Now, if that was World War I, you know, or Vietnam, or a frontline war where your very need to be this obedient is your unit life might depend on it, that's different. But this is boys in school. Every mother said that when their boys got back from the grade 8 camp, they were sitting on the side of the pavement, some of them sobbing, some of them with no clothes, somebody had lost his sleeping bag, they were so bruised. And no one said a word.
Yeah. The guilt
that silence is just awful. Yeah.
It's a silence that's and a guilt that's carried not only by the boys, but so many of the parents you spoke to, Sam. So many of them said over and over again to you, "I was the responsible adult. I took my child and handed them into the hands of a predator. My child was crying and saying they didn't want to go back to hostel. And I told them, toughen up. You've got to just make it to the end of the year. And I went back weekend after weekend and handed them into the hands of Colin Rex and of these matric boys who were abusing them." The guilt that those parents carry must be extraordinarily, I mean, even all these years later, they're still having difficulty processing it, aren't they?
Well, I think for me, the greatest compliment I got on this book was from one of the parents who said to me that for the first time, she thought she could deal with her own guilt because she realized she wasn't the only one. I think what's very difficult is they are told a boy is going to behave in a very sort of childish way when he goes to grade 8 because he's becoming a man. And this is why you send boys to boys' schools so they can become men. And this level of initiation was so unheard of by these parents. It was just, there was no such thing. So they do blame themselves terribly, but how would you know? How could you know that as the school gates closed on your son, that the rules changed completely? Mm. You know, I mean, these boys were being made by matrics. This is putting Colin Rex way over to one side. Matrics were making them stand outside naked in their underpants at 3 a.m. One boy said to me, they've got old pots and new pots. So the new pots are the sand sixes and the old pots are, well, the grade eights. So my age there. And the grade eights are the matrics. Old pots and matrics. And one particular boy said that his old pot was okay. He just made him make toasted cheese because he was running a thriving toasted cheese business in his room. So this kid had to go down there every sort of night and cut bits of cheese. So we laughed about that. Another boy told me that he had to dress his matric in the morning and that his matric used to give him an option of crumbs. How do I do this at the BCSA? Of finishing a morning glory off, mm-hmm. or eating polish, or sucking a mop, or licking the floor. And that was his old pot. So you go from making toasted cheese, which is kind of funny, and you tell your kids about that later, "Oh, when I was in grade 8, I had to make toasted cheese," to how do you tell your kids I once had to French kiss a mop because it was that or something else. Yeah. How do you do that? I mean, what's your point of reference for your kids for school?
Mm. Finding the actual language for it is part of the challenge here, and it's something you engage with in the chapter with Luke Lamprecht, who is the child development and protection consultant who was asked to write the impact report that went into the court case against Colin Rex, talking about the impact on these boys. And he spoke at length about this ludicrous concept of masculinity that was being peddled to them, and the fact that these boys didn't even have the language to describe what had happened to them, because the environment they were in was so steeped in silence and in homophobia. They were being told, you liked it, you must be gay because this happened to you, so don't say anything because that's what we'll think of you. And that actually made his job much harder. And it was something that he actually put together teams to come to the school and have a whole engagement with the entire school body about how to report sexual abuse and what sexual abuse to men looks like. It's tragic that had to happen, though.
It is tragic that it had to happen. And it's tragic that we're in a world where, you know, you actually have to go and explain to boys what is okay and what is not okay. That when you've been beaten and deprived of sleep and had your beds turned upside down, or someone has weed on you, which did happen, or you've been made to sleep in a sewage pipe, and then the sexual stuff comes in, how do you complain? How do you go and talk about it? Especially as some boys had gone and complained about the beatings and got the back even worse. I mean, there are quite a few masters there who have a lot to answer for. And one of the things that annoys me the most is that Colin Rex will be in jail for another 21 years. But there are other people in the education system from that time, still in the education system, and they haven't even been criminally charged. Mm.
For this incident or for the death of Enoch Mbeyanzi, for that matter. And it's one of the big holes in the story, Sam, that I know you deeply regret. You tried so hard to engage with the school itself and with the Education MEC to get their input on this book, and you got nowhere.
So I was quite... what blew me away is I've always had such enormous respect for Panyaza Lusufi. Enormous respect. And I always thought he was one of those MECs who's so hands-on. And I don't know if it just didn't get to him or if his office, I don't know. And I can't blame COVID, because it hadn't started when I started asking. And I asked and asked and asked. And I made it clear, this isn't an expose. It's not a trap. I even submitted a list of questions and I never got a response. Nothing. I got, we've read it, we've passed it on from Steve Maborna. And then that was absolutely it. I had one of the headmasters agree to speak to me. We even had a time, and then he called it off. He said, no, I'm not feeling well. So I said, okay, can we do it later in the week? He said, yes. And then the next day he wrote me an email and said, I've thought about it and I want you to delete all our correspondence and never tell anyone that you spoke to me. So I said, all right, well, that was that. Malcolm Williams, who's a current headmaster, I did email and he did decline. It's his right to decline. Rima Marabito, I had to give him props for speaking to me. Nobody else would. And I sent messages to many teachers. They don't. And the ones who've left say they don't want to know. Parktown has just done enough to them, which there are instances where I think, well, you definitely did enough to Parktown. I mean, it's just the conspiracy of silence. And then when Enoch Mpianzi died, Rams Mabote wrote the most wonderful open letter to the school. And it's in all the social media. I mean, you can Google it. He wrote it on Facebook and it was replicated everywhere. And I phoned him and I said, please, may I use your letter in my book? And he said, of course. And I said, so what response did you eventually get? And he said, I didn't get one. I said, you can't tell me that. And he said he had emailed, he had offered help. I mean, he runs a program for young men. He's absolutely the right person to go in there and help.
And not a word.
He never got a response. Not a word. Trust me, that code of silence, they say the boys don't have it. Well, how can they learn anything else when that's what the adults
That's what's
show
practiced by the adults.
Yeah.
I just want to share with you an email that's come in from Claudine Shields, who's listening to this interview. And I interviewed Claudine a couple of months ago about her own book and her memoir of surviving childhood sexual abuse. And Claudine has written to say, I'm so moved listening to this. Something that was just said has resonated with me very powerfully. It is hard to connect with how serious the abuse is, because you normalize it to cope. You normalize other people's dysfunction because you don't want to dig too deeply into why you were chosen. You're too frightened in case you discover something that you did to cause it. You believe there must be something wrong with you, because surely these grown-ups are behaving normally. They are grown-ups after all. And you need other people to tell you over and over again how bad and wrong it was. That's incredibly powerful stuff, Claudine. Thank you so much for sending that through and re-emphasizing the point. I want to talk about Colin Rex himself, because the surprise here, and you know, I went into this book thinking this is going to be the story of the monster who abused the boys, and to a degree it is. But Sam, you also find that it's not as black and white as that. And Colin Rex himself, as you said, was in his early 20s when he was sent to jail. He was an old boy of the school. He had played water polo there himself. He had learnt how to coach the sport at the hands of another water polo coach who was never named in this book and mentioned by anybody. But he had learned this behavior somewhere. So you finally got the opportunity to go and interview him in prison towards the end of the writing of this book. Tell us what you found when you got there.
So I got there and he walked into the prison visiting room, and the first thing that struck me was how small he was. That he's a little tiny bit taller than me, and I'm not tall. Young, he looks so clean and clean and so polite, so unbelievably polite. And when I sat to talk to him, because I said I'm sitting here with no judgment, I do believe you should be in prison. But the more I hear about you, the more I think that instead of your main role being a perpetrator, your main role is the evidence. Because not all abused become abusers, but many abusers have been abused. And he talked me through what his grade 8 camp had been, how he bled, how he'd had his ribs kicked when he hadn't remembered. They do this thing called the hostel test. And the hostel test is you have to remember everything about every boy in the hostel, every matric. And, you know, if you forget, there's huge punishments. So when I eventually, so what had happened was I had made contact with his fiance, because I wanted to gain her trust. And I said to her, everything I write about Colin, I will send to Colin. He will have full say over what goes in and what doesn't. And the same with you, because I interviewed her as well, as you know. So we went up together and we were sitting there and I asked him questions. He said, ask me whatever you want. I said, you know, did you do this? Did you do that? Did you do the other? And it's detailed in the book. And then I said, do you ever feel remorse? And he said, well, yeah, obviously I do. He said, and I wanted to tell them in court, but I wasn't allowed to read out a letter because my lawyer said it would make it worse. So I said, okay, but have you ever thought about talking to them? Well, he said, I'd like to go back to school, like in my uniform. And when he said that, I thought in your school uniform, but he meant in his prison garb, and explain why you mustn't become like him. So I said, okay. I said, let me change it. And one of the boys, I said to him, if Tyler was sitting here now, because he was particularly fond of Tyler, I said, if Tyler was sitting here now, what would you say to him? And he said, well, obviously I'd say, I'm sorry. And he said, have you spoken to him? And I said, his mum won't let me talk to him because he's very sad and he's been suicidal. And his eyes filled with tears. He was so shocked. He put his hands over his mouth. He said, why? I'm in here. And I said, Colin, because these boys are guilty and shamed because they're teased at school, because some of them have to lie to their parents because they're afraid their parents will think they're gay if they know what happened to them. And that is a true thing. And I said, and they're not okay. Two of them are still on suicide watch. And he was devastated. And he kept saying, but why? I am in here. I am here. They mustn't be sad. I'm in prison. And I realized he's not, his EQ is not that of a functioning adult, I don't believe. So he is remorseful that these boys are so hurt. He really is. But it was all done to him and he was fine. And do you remember the argument about corporal punishment when that was banned? Well, I was beaten as a child and I'm just fine. So, well, are you though?
Well, really, are you? Yeah.
And one of the things he said is the thing that he feels the worst about is that he took away their water polo. And it was because he loved water polo and they were good at water polo. Now they don't play anymore. And it's because of him. And when I told, my husband that, he said, so that's all he cares about. And I said, no, it's like listening to a child. He knows what it's like to have his toy taken away now. So he can feel the pain of someone whose toys were taken away. Mm. And that is when I thought, I mean, he is such a victim in this. And that doesn't make the victim boys any less victims. He knew what he was doing was wrong, or he wouldn't have done it under cover of night.
Yeah.
But the level of wrongness, the fact that he was doing what he was doing on CCTV cameras, that he was videoed, you know.
Cameras he knew were there.
He knew they were there. So I said to him, and I was clear about it, and I'm clear in the book, you need to be in prison. I said, but you're not the only person who should be here. And he needs psychiatric help. He really, really does. Maximum security prison doesn't offer that. So if we've put him in prison to save the rest of the country from him, then yes, we've done a great job. But if we want to find out any more about how abusers have been, how the abused do become abused. If we want to find out anything about that, we've lost our chance if we're even there.
What was astonishing to me, I mean, I mentioned Luke Lamprecht, the child development and protection consultant. Throughout this process, throughout the trial, he was saying to Colin Rex, you are sitting here telling us, I talked like that, I grabbed them underwater because that's what happened to me when I was learning water polo. That's what I thought coaching looked like. And Luke was saying, well, who did it to you? Because tell me who they are. I will go after them as hard as I have come after you, and I will get justice for you as well. And he couldn't. He couldn't bring himself to name a name. Do you think it was because he was unable to recognize fundamentally that it was wrong, Sam? Or do you think it was because he had so bought into the code of silence that it was just not possible to break?
So when I went on my second visit to see him, I sat with his girlfriend and the two of us said, and I said, I've spoken to Luke personally, and he says, if you give those names, he will go after these people. He will get them. And he just shut straight down. He said, no, it's going to ruin people's lives. Oof. And Jolene was nearly in tears. She goes, what about your life? And I said, you're going to be here forever. Do you know that? Do you know you could be here for 21? You'll be 50. You'll be nearly 50 when you get out. And he goes, I'm not ruining anyone else's life. My life's already ruined. And he's told me the stuff that was done to him. And it is in no way, you know, little or trivial at all. He talks about how the boys in the water polo team, they had a fines evening where you drink if you get a fine. And more than one of them was molested during the course of that evening. But he will not give a name. He says his life's already ruined and he's not ruining anyone else's. And that makes my blood boil because they are still out there. They are out there. And what are they doing now?
The one little spark of hope in this whole story is what you said, Sam, about the fact that the matrix of this year were clustered around a pad and pencil, jotting down ideas on how to say this stops with me, which tells me that there is a desire to change. And whether that is being led by the school or internally by the boys themselves in response to what they've learned and seen these boys go through, that spark of hope is there. But the accountability from the school itself is absent in this book. They, as you said, your access to headmasters was virtually null. The follow-up on Enoch's death has been nothing. Nothing has happened. It is months later, and yes, the world has been a strange place in those months and a lot of the country has been shut down, but nothing has happened to change anything. You reference at the end of this book that you went in looking for the rogue in the system and realized the whole system is rogue. I guess the question that all of us want to ask is Sam, what does it take to change the system? Because I read this in horror and think, I have a 13-year-old boy in my household. What is this happening at his school? What if it is? Would he tell me? Would I know? What if this is more widespread than just this individual school, which I think it probably is?
It absolutely is. So one of the moms actually in the book, she says, if your child is sleeping through the entire weekend, if your child's coming home without underpants, if your child is suddenly unbelievably depressed and won't talk to you, this is a problem. You need to look at it. Going back to your original question about the school, this is what needs to happen with the school. You need the school governing body to work with the school management team and to thresh out what is no longer a tradition. See, what's happened from an outsider perspective, what I see is that this school has some extremely proud traditions. It is a wonderful school in theory. It really is. And so there's some very fine people who have come out of it. But what's happened is people have developed bad habits and they call them traditions. It should not be tradition to have to fellate your matric in the morning. It should not be tradition to be beaten and starved when you don't make it to dinner on time. It should not be tradition to be attacked in the showers. That is a habit and those can be broken. The tradition is to look after your brother, to go through and be as one, as a brotherhood. So you have got friends you can rely on for a lifetime who have the same morals and values as you. That's what needs to be focused on. And you need the Luke Lamprechts of the world. You need him to come back in. You need more like him to sit with the boys, to sit with the parents, to sit with the teachers and say, right, this is how we rebuild. There is nothing to be gained from burning that school to the ground, metaphorically or otherwise. And so much to be gained from allowing the current student body and the current parent body to help craft a new beginning.
And yet, as you reference, here you have Rams Mabota, a parent who is expertly placed to help, reaching out, saying, I'm a parent. I am not okay with what I'm seeing here. I would like to help. I believe in this school. I believe in its traditions. I'm not taking my son out of the school. I want him to have the experience of all the things that are good at the school. But let's help change the things that aren't. And nobody answers.
So I think what has happened, and I have to, as I say, I have to surmise because no one would talk to me. So if people say, well, she has no idea, you're absolutely right. She has no idea, but I would have loved to have got one if you'd answered the phone or emailed me. Mm. I think the school needs to pick up the phone is to put this mistaken pride in its pocket and go, we need help. How do we change? So when Luke phones you, pick up the phone. When Rams phones you, pick up the phone. When there are people who are prepared to give their time, their expertise, and who are passionate about education in this country, just pick up the phone.
I'm in conversation with Sam Cowan, who is the author of Brutal School Ties, The Parktown Boys Tragedy. And it is, yeah, the greater tragedy of a system of abuse and of traditionalizing things that should no longer be part of the school experience, and asking questions about what kind of men we are raising and what we are saying to young boys about it, what it means to be a good man. The book is published by Melinda Ferguson Books and it is available in stores now. Sam, before we run out of time, you've signed, because of course these are strange times, we can't do in-person book launches at the book lounge, etc. I know you've signed a whole whack of copies that have been left at the book lounge, and I think Exclusive Books Canal Walkers also got several of them.
So Canal Walker's got, Constantia Village has got, and I'm going through to Claremont tomorrow, so they'll have signed copies as well.
Okay, and it's retailing at about 260 Rand a copy. Is it available in an e-form, Sam, given that a lot of people have switched to e-reading? Yeah.
It is on ebook. I think it is definitely on Amazon. I know people who've bought it and read it from there. I think it retails at about $11. She says confidently, having not actually checked.
Okay. Well, one quick last SMS in from a listener, Mike, saying if there is bullying in a school, the principal and teachers should be arrested and sent to prison because they are complicit. That is a big question here, Sam, that there are still teachers teaching at the school who, on the reading of this book, were complicit, at the very least, chose to look the other way and let it happen and create the environment in which this predator flourished. It is, as you say, a rogue system rather than a rogue in the system that needs to be looked at more closely. Sam, you've done an amazing job. You've done such extraordinary deep research, which I know must have been incredibly taxing on you as a mother, as a journalist, as a writer. So thank you for doing it and for asking the hard questions and doing those hard interviews. It is utterly gripping reading, as difficult as it is. Thanks so much for joining us today and being so generous with the time as well.
Thank you, Pippa.
Sam Cowan, the book is called Brutal School Ties, The Parktown Boys Tragedy.